Welcome to John Bowd's All the Rage here on www.tracksfm.org. This week, John will be interviewing Rian Jones, who's a writer who focuses on music and politics, culture and history, particularly from a working class perspective. Her books include Clampdown, Pop Cultural Wars on Class and Gender, Petticoat Heroes, Gender Culture and Popular Protest in the Rebecca Riots, which concerns the uprising in Wales in the 1800s, and a section of the book Trippich, which focuses on the Manic Street Preachers album The Holy Bible. Her work and media appearances can be found at the Velvet Coal Mine website, www.rianjones.com. Take it away, John.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.tracksfm.org.
Welcome, listeners. I'm in a pub, believe it or not, which to some of my work colleagues will seem odd. Welcome to All the Rage, and this week I have another interview for you. Please.
Hi, my name is Rian E. Jones. I'm a writer from South Wales, originally now living in London. I'm very pleased to be here.
Now, listeners might know a few weeks ago I spent a bit of time with your book Clampdown, which I like very, very much, which of course is talking about Britpop. It also seemed to me to be an alternative view of what was going on at that time that I hadn't really read.
Mm.
And also, speaking as someone who lived through it and didn't have a break of time, it seemed like almost a voice in the wilderness.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much how I felt when I wrote it, to be honest. I guess it is like it's a counter history of Britpop, especially. And all the 90s, and I think it tries to make it probably comes across as a secondary thing, but it tries to make the point that Britpop, first of all, was not the only thing that was going on in the 90s. There's a lot of other music going on, most of which, like, because I was a teenager at the time at school, most of my friends were into jungle or hip hop and that kind of thing, but Britpop was the sort of overriding narrative of the decade, and all sorts of retrospectives on the 90s concentrate on Britpop to the exclusion of everything else. And during the 90s itself, Britpop became weirdly politicised and sort of used as a commercial tool to sell a quite exclusionary image of what it was to be British and what Britain was like at that time. That sort of played into not only sort of like constructions of Britishness as white and male and middle class. So that sort of edged out a lot of identities that were still there in the 90s but weren't really talked about. So, yeah, growing up I kind of felt like a sort of, yeah, a refusenik, I guess, like a voice in the wilderness. So, because you were getting the sort of, we're all middle class now narrative, and we're all sort of chilling out to Blur and Oasis, and everything's great. So, like, well, no, I'm living in a post-industrial unemployment black spot. Everything's dreadful, and everyone still thinks of themselves as being working class. Like, this idea of we're all middle class now was real anathema, but that's what everyone went with.
I didn't even work where I came from, and I live in the suburbs. I mean, we see outside of London.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was a very narrow idea of a country. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And yet we were the people who were supposed to be appealing. I came of age in 1997. It was my first year to vote.
Ah, okay. So you must be the same age, I think, actually.
I left school in 94.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so a bit younger, but yeah, still. My first vote was, I just missed out voting in the 97 general election.
Oh, that's the one.
So,
that was my first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was interesting too.
Yeah, it was.
More voting against than voting for, but we'll come to that later. I found that in hindsight, 1994 is actually quite an interesting year for music, but almost more sort of things that went in a different direction.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think Public Enemy in particular that year released the album Music and No Message.
Ah, yes, they did.
A much kind of, I don't know, revile seems a bit much as well. It wasn't really, it was seen as a bit old hat because music was moving towards commercialism and the celebration of...
Yeah, I remember it being greeted by, this happened to me a lot, like I'd just get into a relatively like old band and then they'd come out with something new and I'd be really excited because I was sort of riding like off the back of their early stuff, and then so I remember being really excited for it when it came out, and then it was received as a bit underwhelming and a bit sort of this is passé now, like why are they so angry, why are they, you know, everyone just needs to chill out a bit. A similar thing with obviously, like, we can talk more about the Manics, but similarly the Manics were still like really depressed, really angry in 1994, the year the Holy Bible came out, and everything else was a bit sort of but why? Why are you still so angry? You know, so that, that went along with the whole, we're all middle class, we all need to just chill out a bit more, etc.
The first time I got into that, because I was very late to the medicine, I mean, I literally got into Holy Bible about 10 years after it came out.
Okay, that's, that happens to a lot of people.
Because me and my cousins started seeing a lot of music, and I'd never really thought of myself as being into the medics. And I heard them live on the radio and went, wow, they sound amazing.
Okay.
And my cousin, who was a long-term fan, said, oh, no, you want to listen to this album right up the street.
Oh, brilliant.
We won't say why. miserable old popular.
I always like hearing about how people got into, particularly the Holy Bible, like, because I wrote a whole book on it, and it was something, because I was about 14 when it came out, so I think I was in many ways the ideal age to to hear it, because it is very, like, the teenage angst is at the at the heart of it.
About it being, you know, very an adolescent now, but not in a, I don't find it in an assaulting way.
No, and it's not meant to dismiss it at all. Like, I think you can, I mean, you don't have to be a teenager to feel angsty. Like, it's just that that's when people tend to indulge it a bit more, or it becomes more expected. But I think people in their, especially in their early 20s now, and even 30s, people that have grown up in a world that hasn't really given them what they were promised when they were younger, or that kind of thing, then it's quite natural to feel slightly dispossessed and slightly angsty. But yeah, I'm always really interested in how other people who weren't in the same situation as me when the album came out got into it. And often it is, and this mostly makes me really old, it's like older relatives recommending it to them, which is, you know,
well,
great. So I'm glad that they did.
My cousin's younger than me, so
okay.
He recommended to me. They just seem to think there was something in there. Yeah, I mean, there's so much of what you say and write about in all this that I really think really kind of puts your finger on the pulse in the way that other people haven't, and that's one thing. What's also interesting, again, 1994, it's like the next world, you're providing the blueprint for a different direction for British rock music.
Yeah, very much so.
Which was very much had its back to, and still remaining resolutely indie, as in, we're not really interested. Well, they're not a band who weren't interested in commercial success, but on their own terms.
Yeah.
Because you write about also Kinnicky.
Yes, definitely.
Again, a band people don't write about much.
Yeah, which amazes me, because they were superb, and they were, like, really, I mean, obviously they never, like, achieved mainstream fame, and they were never number one or something, but I remember them being huge in the music press, and they were on there on Top of the Pops, they were, like, Saturday morning TV, that kind of thing. They could have taken off, but they were, really, really unexpectedly sort of undersold, and just not really given the attention that they deserved, because they were absolutely magical group, I thought.
In some ways, though, does it feel better that they're more like a band that we can all like and everyone else didn't get?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, there's always a sense of maybe slightly cliquey or whatever, but when you discover someone who's also a Kinnicky fan, there's a real sort of like, oh my god, this is unexpected, you know, and it's like, it's like being part of a secret club or something.
Being a suburban white hip hop fan is nothing to me. When I was a kid, it was, you know, describing other kids who liked it.
Definitely.
Really was like, you were. I mean, I'm not even like exaggerating this. Absolutely like that.
That's something I think that it's difficult to get across to, like, the younger generation or whatever, because you've got the internet now, so there's the channels for sort of discovery and sharing of pop culture in general is just magnificent. You've got the entirety of the past everything, last 100 years, that you're at your disposal on, like, YouTube or on Spotify or something, whereas in the 90s we didn't have the internet was just kind of taking off, but I certainly didn't have internet access till I was, like, my very late teens.
You've done a very good story about going to try and get the Holy Bible at your local...
Oh, at Woolworths. Yeah. And again, it was really like... I'd read about this thing, this magical artifact in the music press. I was like, okay, I've got to go down and ask for it, because they probably won't be... won't be selling it, or they might not order it in. And I was... Yeah, I was the only Mannix fan that I knew in my town at that point. I later got my best friend into them, but for a good year it was just me, and I thought, well, I'm gonna sound mad, like maybe they haven't heard of this group, and the album's called The Holy Bible, so it's gonna seem a bit weird asking for that, and they'll say, don't you mean the actual Bible, you know? And then
I remember reading a story of someone in America, a fan, one of the, you know, the small breed of Mannix fans, who went.
Yeah, there are a few hardcore Mannix fans in America.
And they directed them to, like, the Christian rock scene. I think that's what they're looking for. Which just makes sense. You've never heard of it.
Well, yeah, you've got preacher's Bible, etc. Yeah. It sounds very different from what it is, but that's all part of
the
mystique of it.
part of the theory I put, if I can call it a theory, part of the rant I put across my show a few weeks ago, was that I think the Britpop's obsession with the past, in particular looking backward motif, had and complete surface value, is something I think really, really damaged British culture, and I don't really think it's recovered.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's very much what I... and again, it was weird growing up in the 90s because you could kind of see that damage occurring, but there was nothing you could do about it, you know, because you were just an individual music fan. But it's... I think something like it's more long-term effects, I think, became visible in the 2000s, mostly in like how boring a lot of British pop culture became, but also how exclusionary it was. It was very white, very male. Like there were certain roles for women, but you had to fit into those roles. You couldn't really do your own thing, which I think is why, talking Clampdown about sort of Kinnicky kind of like falling through the cracks or something, because they were the image that everyone had of them was working class, but the image of working class women that was dominant at that time didn't really fit with them, and the sort of the idea of like working class glamour, which was like, hugely important to me growing up, and it was something that Kinnicky really captured. But middle class music press didn't really have time for that, and you could see the very early roots of like the chav stereotypes. Like if you're a working class girl, you're obviously promiscuous, like you're easy, all that kind of thing, and that got superimposed on Kinnicky, who weren't like that.
There is some cringeworthy stuff that you talk about in Clampdown of them having interviews.
Oh yeah, and they ask, I mean, the particularly like horrific line where they say, so are you like Viz magazine's the fat slags, only thin? And to which Lauren Laverne says, so what you're asking us is, are we slags?
Yeah.
And I have to say that I don't think like a girl group or a girl artist who is more explicitly middle class would probably not get asked that. They wouldn't be this sort of sniggering and jokey kind of, oh, you're a bit easy, aren't you? Like it's only working class women that get that, or women who are perceived as working class women.
Yeah, and it's funny actually, just as I was coming up here, I was reading in Tripwich, I was reading a part about the judge
Judge Pickles.
That's him, Pickles.
Yeah.
Who, just to remind people that the absolute nightmare of people like him actually existing in power was very much a thing in the 90s, and probably still is. I feel like we've not really covered. With that in mind, do you think there's anyone around today that's frankly any good?
I'm not very into grime, though I always feel massively old when I start to talk about it, but I think that's a really interesting scene and subculture that expresses sort of contemporary British identity in a way that is totally contrary to the way that something like Britpop operated, or even like the sort of the post-Brexit kind of the left behind white working class, that kind of thing. There's a huge cool. Just to say, like, grime is a great counterexample to that, because there's a particularly I started off in London, but I don't think it's particularly restricted to London, because there's I think Manchester and Birmingham have their own grime scenes as well, so it's an urban working class identity that is very British. Like you wouldn't get that anywhere else in the world, I don't think, other than in Britain, but it's not the same that the sort of UKIP Brexity kind of stereotype of working class identity. So I think it's really valuable for that. Also good tunes, so I should probably have started off with that.
I did a couple of things the other week on the show. One was, and you kind of referred to this already, but I said to Dave, my co-presenter, can you really remember anything culturally or specifically musically from the first decade of the 2000s?
That's the thing. I mean, I was a huge, I go into this in Clampdown a bit, I was a huge Libertines fan. Again, I don't really listen to them that much today. I think that they very much sort of filled a void, because the void in the early 2000s was so massive. I was like, there's no good music around anymore. Certainly no good like guitar music, like of the stuff I used to listen to as a teenager. That's just gone. So the Libertines, the subculture around them was something I was very into. But if I hadn't been living in London, hadn't been socialising in East London and going to the sort of guerrilla gigs, that kind of thing, then maybe that would also have passed me by. Yeah, I feel bad for people who didn't have that.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Trax FM, Trax FM, Trax FM.
Damn, I got got these bitches on lock though. Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. They drag me in the house and then they lock though. They fighting for the number one spot though. Whoa. I got these bitches on lock though. Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. They drag me in the house and then they lock though. They fighting for the number one spot though. Whoa.
Man, I got, damn, I got, and I got. Cause man, I've got 9 o'clock. That man are cleaning up now. Cause man are cloths and a man are ops. But I don't do it and I'm a city. Cause them man are soft, man are cough. Throw a spanner in the works now. Straight shot, man are box. Pull my sword, it is stone. Camelot, I'm a Hannah's house. And the hammer in the Hannah got. When the hammer drop, she likes to hold my hand a lot. Look, Hannah, stop. And my manner was kinda digital and analog. And I got.
Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. They drag me in the house and then they lock though. They fighting for the number one spot though. Whoa. I got these bitches on lock though. Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. They drag me in the house and then they lock though. They fighting for the number one spot though. Whoa.
Stephanie, Beverly and Bethany. Definitely. Yeah. And I got that loud pack. Even deaf for me. Hey, when I'm chilling out, she wanna ask me questions. Jeopardy, every weaponry. My nigga to the left of me. Secondary. Man, I got the pussy on lock though. Grabbing up my willy, made my cock grow. Maybe, maybe so, or maybe not so. But I want that pussy quite a lot though. Yo, equity. They finna neck and neck with me. Better be energy. Ella came with Emily and Ebony.
Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. They drag me in the house and then they lock though. They fighting for the number one spot though. Whoa. I got these bitches on lock though. Damn, I got these bitches on lock though. They drag me in the house and then they lock though. They fighting for the number one spot though. Whoa.
I also brought up to Dave, my co-producer, because he said to me, like, oh, but what, you know, maybe I just quite like these bands. Or I said, well, I guess that's all right, but it kind of seems like a way of someone trying to end the conversation before it starts. Just go, well, what voice?
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, I like some of the voices. Like, they're not a... yeah, I wouldn't argue that they should all be sent off to gulags or like their records mulched in the landfill or anything like that. Which again, like it's, I don't know, I simply find it interesting when you try and have a conversation like that with someone and there's a sort of, yeah, there's a reticence to discussing it. I mean, the classic response I always get is like, oh, aren't you overthinking this? Like, well, maybe, but I mean, what harm is it doing? Like, I enjoy thinking critically about culture and talking critically about it. I think a lot of people do, even if they wouldn't phrase it in those terms. Like, everyone likes discussing why they like bands or why they like certain films, that kind of thing. So the whole sort of don't overthink it. Yeah, fair enough. Like, people, and people do just enjoy music. I mean, there's music that I don't think critically about and I just enjoy it, and it's fine for other people to do that as well. However, it's interesting, I think. And no more than that. I'm not even saying it's significant or it's important. It's just interesting to look at it in its cultural context, see what cultural trends or what political uses were made of this music. That's just interesting to me. I think, like, as a historian and a music fan, like, it's just... it's fun, actually, to bring those two things together.
Well, I argue, and have done on the show, that the fact is culture is more important to us. And I went into a detail on that on the show the other way too, and in particular, I aimed my sights at only fools and horses, which, for me, it does have certain working class stereotypes. I remember this conversation with my dad, because he could never watch that show, and he was quite uncomfortable. And he said, because I grew up in Campbellwell, and I knew Del Boy, and he wasn't funny, he was a scumbag and ripped people off. And it makes me uncomfortable to see it. And that was, talk about like cultural analysis, that was something he said to me like 20 years ago, I really went,
That's really, yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. And it's not something, again, you don't get that viewpoint presented. You just get Del Boy falling through the bar is like the funniest comedy scene of all time. That's what anyone takes from it, which it is. But yeah, it's interesting to have, because yeah, those sort of working class voices don't, yeah, like real non-fictional working class voices often don't get the chance to talk about their own lives and describe their own experiences. Well, yeah, meanwhile, I mean, you've got them stereotyped.
Zanon Jones once said, "Where's the last time you saw a positive trade unionist in a TV show?"
Exactly. Yeah. I always used to again, sort of 2000s. Like, a lot of my middle class friends really like Shameless, and they would sort of, yeah, they say, "Oh, you must watch it. You'll find it really heartwarming." I'm like, no, this is, I'm not really reckoning, just because I am working class doesn't mean that my upbringing is the same as, yeah, like, there's a difference between growing up in, like, miners terrace, which I did, and a council estate. Like, those are both valid working class experiences, but they are different, so to have them all, like, elided and lumped in together, I found it uncomfortable. I didn't find it heartwarming. I was like, these people have really crap lives and they're doing the best they can, that's not heartwarming.
One thing I remember about Shameless is the amount of TV interviews. Reviewers, sorry, particularly from the Mail and place like that, really saw this as, well, I kind of think they didn't kind of say, I think they thought it was a documentary.
Kind
of claimed, this worships these work shy, lazy scum.
Like
a justification program for saying, well, this is why you don't help these people, because they're scum, they don't help themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, there's a lot of things going on with that, I think. First of all, the very fact that you don't often see portrayals of working class lives on television means that when you do, there's a weird weight of responsibility that's placed on it. Like, if you're going to show working class people, you can't show them being irresponsible, or you can't show them being, you know, silly or idle or whatever, because you have to... which is ludicrous. Like, the solution to that is having more portrayals, vastly different portrayals of working class lives in all sorts of programs, so you're not looking at the only representation as being like an ambassador for everything else. I think at the same time it was, because around the same time there was like poverty, it's described as like poverty porn, but like programs like Benefits, Streets, yeah, so all of that was around at the same time, which was very explicitly sort of saying these people are irresponsible, they're work shy, etc., etc. If you've got an agenda like the Daily Mail has, and it's easy to draw those things together and criticise one for celebrating an irresponsible lifestyle while you vindicate the other for, you know, responsibly portraying how irresponsible the working class are. So yeah, all that was wrapped up. God, it was a terrible, yeah, it was a terrible time. I just thought back to that. I'm not even sure if we've moved on. I think we've just stopped. Yeah, I don't know, post-austerity, I don't even, we're not post-austerity, but sort of in the age of austerity, I don't even know if those kind of portrayals, I think they served their purpose in allowing austerity to be enforced. Where they've gone, though, I don't know if they're still being produced or not. So I haven't seen, since like 2013, 2014, I haven't seen a programme like Benefit Street about. Seems like it's sunk into the national consciousness enough that it's done its job.
Can we talk about Rebecca Wright, which you have written a book about?
Yeah, yes. I kind of describe, they're always, whenever I say, I'll describe them simply, and then I think, well, they're kind of complicated, actually, to describe. The Rebecca Riots, or Rebeccaism, was a social movement that happened in southwest Wales in the 1840s. They're mostly remembered as having been a protest against charging to travel on privatised roads. So they responded to this by attacking and dismantling the toll gates that were set up to charge people. But they also... basically, it was, in the book I describe it as like a Victorian version of Occupy.
Yeah.
So they respond, this social and political and economic malaise is affecting a certain community. Local authorities aren't really willing to do anything or to even listen to the grievances of the community, so they take matters into their own hands. They start opposing tolls for road travel. They also oppose workhouses. The shake-up of welfare that's happening at the time, which results in women being denied child support, that kind of thing. They oppose that. They also agitate for higher wages, lower rents, lower church tithes, all this kind of thing. I think there's a period of about 6 months, I think, where the entire country is in the grip of this. And then it kind of burns itself out a bit and dies down, and people become less militant, or you get a more you get a more militant fringe of the movement coming into prominence, and then the more conservative elements start to have second thoughts and draw back from it. What happens a bit later on is that the government then sends a commission of inquiry down to the area to sort of tour and see what people's grievances are, and then they come up with a report that doesn't really fix anything apart from the toll gates. So it says we've sorted out a bit of the toll gate system, but they leave everything else, which is basically the imposition of industrial capitalism. Like, all of that is left as it is. Those grievances never get sorted out.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Trexifer.
Basically, which always surprises people. And I don't know if there was some sort of I said this on Desolation Radio. I don't know if there was some sort of entryist conspiracy in the late 90s to get really radical history taught. But we did a whole module that was on the Rebecca Riot's Chartists in Wales, the Tithe War in North Wales, and the Merthyr Rising in 1831. We were just Yeah, we were taught local radical history as part of my GCSE. So that was the first time I encountered it. Well, yeah, I mean, I just kind of thought this happened all the time. So, like, when I tell it to people and they're like, wow, that's amazing. Like, yeah, everyone should grow up knowing their history. This is the thing. And if that includes political struggle and radicalism.
I do like this story about where one of the places they think Rebecca came from as part of her, and this was the rather large miner who apparently had to borrow a dress.
Tom Carner Booth, I'm probably pronouncing that wrongly. This was the third, so there had been two attacks on the same toll gates in Failwen in Carmarthenshire. The third attack was the first time that the riots were led by their sort of symbolic leadership figure of Rebecca, who was played by a man in women's clothing but also a false beard. So the first man to do this obviously needed to borrow a dress. So, yeah. Apparently the only woman in the local community who was sufficiently statuesque to lend him a dress was called Rebecca and was known locally as Big Becca. So the apocryphal story is that's how, because she lent her dress to the leader of the protest, so they borrowed her name, so that's why it's Rebecca. And there's another sort of more sober and high-minded version which says that it's from the Book of Genesis. So you've got those two rival origin stories, which I like.
That is cool. So, I mean, would you ultimately, aside from some of the later violence that got more involved, which may or may not have been by people not directly connected to it, I think, other than that, do you think it's a very positive community action?
I think so. I mean, the very fact that we sort of, it's remembered, not particularly like prominently, but it's definitely in Welsh history as quite a playful sort of carnivalesque sort of thing, which isn't the case with other Welsh protests, which are very grim, very serious, etc. But this is I think something people remember positively, and because it's quite fun. But even the sort of the dressing up element is something that that inclines people to think positively about it, I think. And you still get I was doing some work a couple of weeks ago with a youth theatre group, which is bringing together students from Hackney Community College with some students from Wales, and they were doing a play that was bringing together the Rebecca riots and the 2011 London riots. So they were sort of just thinking about their own experience and their own history, but also looking at this history. But yeah, the fact that the Rebecca riots are normally chosen for that kind of remembrance, I think speaks well of it, because it's colourful and it's fun, and yeah, something people can get their teeth into as a story as well as politics and history, I think.
You wrote an essay occupied the toll gates in 2015, and there was a comment that you made which just stuck in my head.
Okay.
And it was, for me, having an interest in history is a function of growing up in a place which often seems to consist, as the poet observed, of nothing but the past.
Yeah. I mean, that's Wales to me, basically. I mean, I go back regularly, but I also like got out as early as I could. Something. My earliest political memories, I guess, are involved the miners' strike and involved deindustrialisation. And so much of the struggle against that involved looking back to the past, which were also struggles that we'd lost. Like people look back to the general strike, or more positively, like the strikes in the 70s, which actually brought down the Heath government. And sort of Heath went to the country and said, "Who runs Britain?" And the answer was the National Union of Mine Workers. So there was that, but so much, yeah, it seemed like every action in your everyday life politically was actually a reaction. It was informed by what had gone before. So there's, I think the weight, the consciousness and the weight of the past in Wales is something that's incredibly heavy, and makes it very difficult to actually do something original, or take things in a slightly different direction. And it's good. I mean, I'm all for, obviously as a historian, like I'm all for knowing about the past and honouring the past in some way, but it can feel quite stifling when you look back and all you can see is, you know, struggle and defeat and loss. Yeah, it doesn't make for good psychologically healthy nation, to be honest with you.
No, I think that's quite accurate. Also, you write about it as being an inevitable feeling of defeat. But also, the place of geography in our lives and how it affects us. I think I can relate to it. Sometimes you're outside of your place of geography, mm-hmm. your workplace, your living space.
Yeah, yeah.
wouldn't do things very differently.
No, definitely.
Those wheels, whatever that is. Because I've got a feeling that's probably coming up.
Oh, okay.
just one last thing on that. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be, as we discussed, kind of an effective kind of raised working class.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, any that features women very prominently.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder, do you think it's one more than the other, or are they just mutually?
I think women are often, this is a criticism of both left and right, really, I guess. Women are often an afterthought, even in working class history. And particularly when conservative or liberal forces try to talk about the working class, often what they have in their head is a man. Like the idea of a working class woman just as a figure, and normally this man is an unemployed mine worker or steel worker, always white, always living in the North or South Wales. That's not what the working class looks like at the moment, and it's never what the working class has exclusively looked like. But there's this sort of catering to, just in order to show that you have credibility as a liberal or middle class commentator or conservative commentator, you have to talk about the working class and show that you understand them, but the understanding is in such stereotyped, simplistic terms. I mean, the classic example, I think, is like Blue Labour, which was... So even though it's still going, I know it was like a big project a few years ago, but Maurice Glasman, the architect of Blue Labour, conceptualised the Labour Party as being like a cross-class marriage, with the working class partner being a dad, who stood for like the trade union and sort of institutional tradition, and then the other half of the marriage was a woman who is middle class and who represented like the Fabian sort of gradualist tradition. That's a valid way to conceptualize the party, but examining the way it's constructed and the assumptions there, like why is working class always male, why is middle class always female, because that leaves the way open for connections with right wing forces who would say feminism has disempowered working class men. Like, well, A, I don't think it has, but even if it has, B, are there no women in the working classes, that sort of thing. I always find it, as a working class woman, like, found that incredibly frustrating. It's like, we're here,
To add to that, it's the idea of women coming and taking male jobs.
Yeah, there had to be the Mines Act, I think... 1880 something had to be passed to ban women from working in the mines, because before that coal owners and iron masters were working women to death as well as men. It was only because it wasn't considered respectable for women and men to work in the same space underground that they banned women from working there. So women have always worked. This is something that is staggeringly under acknowledged.
Which brings us quite nicely. In no sense of planning, we're talking about Manic Street Preachers, a band you are a fan of, and you've written about them a lot. What specifically do you like about them?
They were the first band that I was ever, the first contemporary band that I was ever obsessive about. I think I grew up being very into punk, but obviously this was the early 90s, so a lot of the bands I discovered weren't around anymore. The Manics seemed to have a lot of the spirit of punk in them, and they were obviously hugely influenced by The Clash, and just by punk in general. I was just really excited to have a band that were, alive and functional, and whose music I liked. Again, a complete critical misstep, because the first Manics album I got was Go Against the Soul, which everyone hates and thinks is overproduced and too slick. I really liked it, aged 13 or whatever I was.
John Bounce, John the Rage, on Tracks FM, Tracks FM.
So yeah, sorry, we were just chatting, and I noted a quote from your chapter on the Manics in Triptych. I might as well read it on the tape. We spent the 90s being assured by politicians, media and popular culture that we are all middle class now. The 90s was post-ideological, when what we meant was post-socialist. So tell me about that.
Yeah, that's a line that a few people have picked up on as being something that they experienced themselves or sort of intuitively got while growing up in the 90s but hadn't seen it expressed in that way. It was always again bizarre to me, like being told that we were all middle class now when, you know, I could just look out of the window and see that we weren't. It felt very similar to being told that it's the end of history and liberal capitalism is the way forward and things will never move forward from here. Also just felt very implausible. As it's come to pass, but the idea that the end of history had happened and that this was the collapse of the grand narratives always felt very disingenuous, because it was very obvious that the grand narrative they meant was, you know, the working class struggle and the movement forward towards socialism. And no one ever talks about obviously it's part of hegemony, but like no one talks about capitalism as being an ideology. Yeah. No one talks about the free market as being a dogma. You know, when it's equally as implausible to talk about socialism and say, as some of its critics do, oh, you know, it's a nice idea, but it places too much faith in human nature, when actually human nature is venal and selfish and individualistic. It's okay, but what about capitalism, though? I mean, I guess that's a nice idea in theory, but it totally neglects the fact that human beings are, you know, naturally acquisitive. And exploitative. The idea that capitalism is not equally as ideological and dogmatic as socialism has always been bizarre to me. But yeah, the whole idea of the end of history and the collapse of grand narratives was just anti-socialist. It wasn't anti-ideology. I went to university in the early 2000s, and I studied. I went to fairly left-wing or liberal institutions. I did history and politics, so you would think there would be some scope for talking about class within that, but we were in like a postmodernist, post-structuralist turn, so attention to class was really frowned upon and was sort of like, oh, that's a bit unsophisticated, shouldn't you be reading, you know, Gareth Stedman Jones, or shouldn't you be paying attention to the languages people use, not their material circumstances and not how they conceptualize their own experience. You know, it's all a bit, you need to be a bit more sophisticated, so, you know, class is very passe now. Which struck me at the time as a bit odd, but you know, I was 18, so I wasn't going to contradict my professors or anything. I just sort of, yeah, went with it. So I've been, yeah, for the past 20 years, I've been gradually working my way back around to actually addressing class as a material experience, and it just feels like, I don't know, academically it feels like a lot of time was wasted. Even like Zero Books, who I think have put out some really excellent stuff, so much of it is clearly just really itching to directly express left populism or socialism, but instead they have to do it through the guise of a critique of Batman or the new Beyonce video or something. You know, I'm just like, guys, it's okay to talk about class, it's okay to say that you like socialism, just come out and say it. You don't have to dress it up in theory and cultural criticism. Let's have a political conversation, you know. That's really frustrated me over the past 10 or 20 years, but I think we are coming out of it. I think
what I find very telling now is that when you have someone like Ash Sarkar the other saying that I'm literally a communist,
yeah which was great,
lots of very red-faced English people on interviewing on that. What about it? Well, firstly, here's my question. Would you show me a successful socialist country? Well, show me a successful capitalist country.
Well, yeah, and also Yugoslavia.
And also this kind of obsessive... I don't know if you saw this, but somebody on Fox News... I mean, why anyone bothers referring to Baptism? But said it had a guy in Denmark. And a politician in Denmark,
okay.
I can't remember his name, but he did a video at Momentum of him going...
Okay, I missed
okay,
this,
here's
totally.
What you said. I hadn't come out yesterday, I think.
Okay.
Here's what you said, and here's the truth about what Denmark's really like.
Brilliant.
And it just seems nice that people are doing that now.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I really think... I mean, the fact that... I think left populists and socialists across the world just like have their tails up at the moment and are not. We're not cringing anymore. And I think this was a huge part of the post-90s left was that we cringed. We just felt a bit embarrassed about being left-wing. And like, you're not gonna win your opponents round by seeming embarrassed about what you believe in. They're not embarrassed about what they believe in. They're not embarrassed about being Thatcherites, free marketeers, crypto-fascists in some cases, you know? Why should we be embarrassed about standing for things that we believe in, which are incredibly, in most cases, incredibly mild social democratic reforms, renationalising the railways, you know, higher minimum wage. That's it. And an easing of austerity. In most cases, that's all that people are being asked to vote for, certainly under Corbyn. Like, to behave as though that's some sort of, you know, incipient Stalinist existential threat, you know, it's just absurd. And I think people see through that bullshit now. People are not taking that criticism at face value.
I think much of the British press has really lost it. Now, I might be a little bit late to the party saying it. I understand that, but I saw the critiques to begin with, and I was always a little bit, I'm not sure it's definitely going down yet.
Yeah.
But now I'm getting to the point, I was actually thinking, actually, yeah, you're probably fucking right. I think it is. Not too soon either, because they deserve it. But also, I think that even the BBC have become more difficult. Now, I've defended the BBC, and as an institution, I still will defend it.
Yeah, no, it's been genuinely quite like heart-wrenching for me, because I love the idea of a national public-funded broadcaster. I think one of the factors that's influencing the decline of the BBC is that they are in hock to the government for funding. Like, the government may revoke the licence fee at any point. So again, they're kind of cringing, and they're in thrall to. We have to appear balanced. Fair enough, balance is good, but balance does not mean you have, one person in to dispute the existence of climate change, or to say that Tommy Robinson is a national hero. You know, that's not balance. Like, the balance is reflecting the balance of political forces in the country.
But not just that, but so shout out to the BBC if anyone's Explain to me the worth of balance when you have something like Question Time and you put, well, basically the majority of people on there are millionaires anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Secondly, you get so much, so you think, like, one example I use is David Arnovich and George Galloway on the same show. You know they don't like each other. You're only putting them on the show to get YouTube clickbait.
Yeah, of course.
And by the end of the programme, what have you actually learnt?
Yeah.
I've never learnt anything from
them. Absolutely.
And look, like anyone else, especially in the last decade, I've watched, you know, some Tory get wiped on the floor. That's great. And then gone to bed.
Yeah.
And
it's basically a circus and a ding-dong. And the fact that they... I mean, yeah, and again, like, I'm not the first person to make this criticism, but they have Nigel Farage on there. Oof. Way more than they have... I mean, the Green Party, you know, got more votes than UKIP, but
UKIP
at one point. So, you know, why aren't they getting an equivalent amount of access and coverage?
You never want to see in British government.
Yeah, and Nigel Farage is the most unsuccessful politician of all time.
No, I completely agree. He's completely joking.
I mean, but yeah, he's treated with fighting kid gloves by these people. And Boris the same. Obviously, Boris has been democratically elected, but, you know, the fact that he's not ever held to account.
So moving on to kind of more general stuff.
Okay.
Going forward, the gig economy and trade unionism, which is something we talk about on the show a lot. We did do a show a while back about the Virginia teachers' strike. I don't know if you remember that, but that's a really interesting kind of... Speaking of histories that have been wiped over, the working class history in Britain has been bad enough.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just been eradicated. But, you know, West Virginia is a very different kind of place. And again, telling this story, you probably know this, but some of the listeners might not. One of the big mining strikes 80 years ago, the fellas used to tie these red sashes around their necks. And they're the ones who became known as rednecks. But it's actually a good thing in those days, because they were hard militant trade unionists.
No, that's amazing. And so much of the history is unknown. Yeah, I mean, even outside, like, I'm someone who does read a lot of left-wing socialist history, but, like, there's so much really cool left-wing history in America that I was totally unaware of. Even, like, the Haymarket massacre, like, all the US anarchists, all that kind of thing.
Do you ever
just wasn't aware of it.
Jacobin magazine. A couple of days ago, actually, they published a very interesting article about The False Martyrdom of Tommy Robinson. That's an anti-fascist, I tend to speak about him a bit. Little Tom is his name to us.
Yeah, I find the martyring of him like incredibly worrying, and also particularly because a lot of it seems to be driven actually by US
it is now.
Conservatives as well, so they've latched onto him without having the first clue about the British context of what he's criticising or what he's doing. Yeah. And
he left,
I mean,
he left the EDL,
yeah, because he was EDL, yeah, so they
he was over.
Yeah, then he was given a new lease of life by
media and a lot of the American media.
Yeah.
Too, and that's it. Now all of a sudden he's got a new career.
It seems so obviously disingenuous to me. Like these, as far as I can tell, I mean, the most charitable impulse I can attribute to these people is that they all want to make some money, which, okay, I can understand that. But to weaponize racial hatred and Islamophobia to do that is a bit like, okay, if you can live with yourself. Fine, but yeah, it seems, yeah, because that seems so obvious, I am kind of horrified to see how many people are falling for it and are thinking of him as like a free speech martyr and a working class hero, which is really, really galling.
Right. It's ironic that they keep putting this picture around, the one with him with a bit of tape over his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
That's the best photograph I've ever seen. why are you putting this in his bad face? I couldn't agree more. The 1980s and 90s, I believe, have a really difficult overhang, especially for working class people.
Yeah.
It seems like the defeats that we've talked about, it seems like the erosion of the idea of talking about any of these things really seems to impede us today.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as bad. I think there's a lot of natural growth with, you know, natural trade unionising of people like Deliveroo, Uber, and even though they call themselves a union, they're using the tools.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and the cleaners strikes recently in John Lewis, Ministry of Justice cleaners. Yeah.
Shout out to Claudia, you know, good friend of ours. So it just feels feels to me like there's great restriction of opportunity, especially in the media. But also there's more opportunities if we can grab them. That makes some sense.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it always this is quite a frustrating perspective for me, but it almost feels like we've spent the past couple of years reinventing the wheel. Like we've had to reinvent trade unionism, basically, because the TUC has not always done its best to reach out to like precarious workers. Hasn't really engaged with the gig economy at all. And it hasn't. I mean, historically, sectors like fast food workers or retail workers that were historically under-unionized because of high staff turnover and the hostility of bosses, that wasn't really addressed by the big established unions. Now you had, like last year was the first strike by McDonald's workers in the UK. So, you know, they can be unionized. Clearly, it's not that unionization or workers' rights is some sort of anathema to them. It's just that they haven't been accommodated and given leadership by the big unions. I mean, I used to work in an independent bookshop where, again, like we tried. We were all very unhappy with our situations. We tried with Unite. They weren't a great deal of help. We tried with the other big unions. It was the WGB that were the most helpful. I think these sort of autonomous grassroots unionisation, even like wildcat strikes, seems like a perfectly appropriate response to something like the gig economy, which have in which employers are cutting corners and are sidestepping processes that they should go through. So, yeah, workers doing the same seems to be an appropriate response.
I think, is it not necessarily, though, the smaller unions are perhaps better at this? I mean, United works the world successful. And quite rightly, I don't believe there's any interest in them to be. They're happy to be in solidarity with bigger unions like mine, but they don't really want to be directly involved. I mean, we, the CWU, had a few issues years ago, we tried to recruit a UK male.
And then
it was a little over the place. So we were very kind of half in, half out the door. Sometimes I think actually maybe the big unions are counterproductive to that.
Oh yeah, well I think this is a like truism, but like the smaller you are, the more sort of adaptable and like agile you are in terms of responding, and particularly if you have sort of on the Italian model, if you have like smaller. Small unions within individual workplaces. There'll be different. There'll be different ways to respond, and there are ways that you can respond appropriately to your bosses and your particular environment, whereas if you were relying on a national union to respond for you, they wouldn't know exactly what was going on in your particular circumstance. So, yeah, you can give a better response if you're smaller, I think, or more independent. Talking about Grenwick earlier, yeah, I mean, that was something that, I mean, even though, so that those were mostly Asian women who were taking action on their own behalf, which was significant in itself, but also the miners, the NUM, turned out to support them, and that was amazing. I mean, that was, I mean, talk about intersectionality, like that was intersectionality before it had a name, but when it was just called solidarity, it was called unions turning out to support each other. So that's big. And the miners, and you look at sort of the 80s as well, the sort of alliances between the miners and gay rights organisations, all that kind of thing. The NUM has historically been really progressive in making alliances, but yeah, I agree that that's the that's not representative of the entire trade union movement. They've often been very reticent, very stolid and sort of set in their ways and not ready to accommodate changing nature of the working class, basically.
And now they, more than ever, really need to stop that shit, because...
Aye, totally, totally.
Because whether you like it or not, it's changed. It's massively changed. We're a different breed now.
Yeah, absolutely.
In different places.
Yeah, they have to move with the times, basically. Yeah. It's not enough to just be complacent anymore.
No, I agree. Have we ceased to be able to create anything new? Is that the real overhang of the 80s and 90s?
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I read Retromania. I thought it had a lot of interesting observations to make about contemporary culture. But then I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at things like the grime scene, and specifically Grime for Corbyn as well, which was not unprecedented, because you have things like Red Wedge in the 80s and that kind of thing. But in terms of like how it utilised social media and the momentum that it gained, and just to use it using memes and like viral videos or that kind of thing, I think that was kind of new. Like I certainly wasn't expecting it.
Okay, well, I suppose we can begin to round up by saying, what are you up to next? What do you want to plug?
Well, after I wrote a history book on the Rebecca Riots, I am also working on a novel that's set during the same period, so it's basically very Dickensian, bit Les Mis, etc. But that's I've just been basically doing that in my spare time or my day job and my other non-fiction writing. So that might be hoping to get that finished before the end of the year, and then I'll be trying to pitch it probably badly.
If someone wants to make a musical, will you give them an audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I may even sing, yeah.
Well, so Annie Jones, thank you very much for speaking to All The Rage. And please come back again sometime.
Thank you.
All The Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.